Okay, so last week we started talking about Ribis, which is Parshas Bahar, and Parshas Bahar we knew the last week, we could go on forever, and Ribis also, ironically, we could keep adding to and adding to and adding to, and wouldn't end, but even if we were to try to keep it relatively contained, so we still needed to have at least one session to introduce Rebbes and one to talk separately about Heter Iska. So maybe if we have time, maybe we'll add some of the other many other details about Rebbes that we didn't get to last week. We'll see. We'll have to figure out how many weeks we can allot to this, but to try at least a little bit to explain some of the background and some of the details of the fascinating device that's known as the Heter Iska. So to try to give a little bit of context, so we'll have to go into much more detail to explain, but just to give a rough one-word introduction, one-sentence introduction, so on the surface, the Heter Iska is a tool that developed over the past few hundred years to structure a loan in a way that should allow for the provider to collect extra than what he provides in the context of a business setting. And explain a lot more about that, but that's just to give a very brief kind of definition. So first, to note, so last week when we started talking about Ribis, so we gave a few theories as to what Ribis is about. And none of them were absolute, necessarily, but do we have full confidence in by itself. But as a package, we used to explain how could it be that the Torah prohibits charging interest and does so if Ribis was about exploiting the vulnerable person in need. If that's all it was about, then we're not allowed to take advantage of such a situation. So then, okay, we can understand that. That certainly made sense. But we noted that there are details that are much harder to understand. For example, the fact that there's a prohibition of taking any amount of Ribis, even something that could be very reasonable, that the prohibition applies even to the borrower, who's supposed to be the victim in that scenario, and the borrower is also not allowed to be mochel, not allowed to waive the situation and say it's okay. Also very hard to understand if he's supposed to be the victim in this story. And also the fact that this is something that applies only when dealing with Jews, and if this was a moral violation, then we would have expected it should be applied more broadly. So we gave a few theories to try to explain why that is. Just very quickly to recap, so we gave the possibility that it's about treating other Jews like they're part of an extended family. And even though it might be reasonable to charge some basic rate of interest, but you don't do that to your family, you treat your family differently. And that we understood was a ben odem l'chaveiro, but kind of an enhanced ben odem l'chaveiro, something more than what would be required by basic morality. We also mentioned the possibility that maybe it is kind of a benign moral because it's an insult to God in that here God tells us to treat others with chesed, to be there to help people in need. And we're essentially saying that we're happy to do that as long as we're guaranteed in advance that we will make just as much as we would have if we had left the money in the bank. Nothing fancy, a very basic rate of return, but we ask that that should be guaranteed. And that's not an offense against the borrower who's happy to get that deal. It's an offense against God who asked us to engage in chesed. And here, lending money is one of the primary examples of chesed in the Torah. And we're essentially saying that we're only going to get involved if we have guaranteed coverage. And that's not an offense against the borrower. He might be happy to have that. It's an offense, perhaps, against God. And in that case, it's really understood maybe as a ben odem l'mokom, as the Yerideya concept, as indeed Hilchos Ribis is found in Yerideya, and maybe not a choshen mishpat concept. Our third possibility we mentioned is that it gets in the way of our being able to help people in an objective way. That if we understand that halva is part of our concept together with staka, we're asked to help people out in need. And when it comes to staka, there are priorities. There's a whole hierarchy of rules as to how to decide who to help, who to help first. So if we were able to be paid for that choice, if we could take payments in order to give to one person rather than another, that would skew the whole process, and it would be perhaps comparable to the shofet. If we were to give the mashal, if we were to imagine, for example, that it wasn't our money at all, but that we were administering a fund that was donated to by others, and we were asked to decide who to give it to first, so certainly we would see a big ethical problem in accepting payments from those who were on the list. We would have to be careful not to be biased in who to choose as a priority, and allowing one to pay for that privilege of getting the loan would perhaps certainly be an ethical problem. So that would help us to understand why the borrower isn't able to be mocha and why he's part of the yeser, because he's part of the problem. He's not the one who's not getting the money, not getting the loan. And that can also explain why Ribbis Tvarim, of the person just treating you nicely, which doesn't seem to come at any cost to the recipient. But if we see it within a framework of Shochat, so that's something maybe we could understand a little bit more clearly. And the fourth possibility we mentioned is that maybe Ribbis is exactly what it looks like. It really is about exploiting the borrower, but it's prohibited at any rate at all because we just make it essentially, it kind of makes it as a low point. We have no way of necessarily drawing the line of where it's acceptable and where it's too much. And the prohibition also applies to the borrower because if he was able to be mochel, if he was able to say, well, it's fine, you're protecting me, but I don't need it, so then everyone will have to be mochel. No one will get the loan unless they're willing to suspend their right to have it interest free, and that's going to make the whole system fall apart. So in order for it to be an effective protection, it would have to be across the board and not allowing for any mechila. So those were four perspectives that we mentioned as to why it is that the prohibition of ribbis has all these unexpected details, and there's a lot more to say about it as well. But what is common to all of those theories, even though we may not be sure that it's one or the other, but what seems to be common to all of those theories is that there is a notion here of chesed, and that, like you said, the halva is perhaps the paradigmatic example of chesed, of being there to help people in need, and this is really kind of a standard, perhaps, for the whole notion of chesed, which is so central to our identity as Jews. A major theme as we approach Shavuos, the notion of chesed as central to the Jewish mission. So the Torah is telling us to take care of people and not to charge them, not to exploit them while doing so, not to do so only under the condition of being paid. However you see it, it all revolves around this idea that we are there to help people in need. So that could help us to appreciate how the Heter Iska is consistent with at least the spirit of the law. Because the assumption that we'll start with, and we'll address this in more detail as we go, but the assumption that we'll start with is that the Heter Iska is really only appropriate when providing capital for business purposes. So that if somebody comes to you and says that they're looking to start a business, and they need help in order to do that, or they need some capital in order to be able to do what they want to do. So then, in that context, a Heter Iska could be appropriate. But if it's not for the purposes of something like that, but the person comes to you and says they can't pay their rent, they can't pay their medical bills, they can't buy groceries, and you say, okay, I'll help you out, then here's the Heter Iska for you to sign, so that there'll be a guaranteed extra return for me. So that would be inappropriate. That would be a violation of the spirit of Hilchos Ribbis. Again, we'll get into a little bit more detail about that. But I think we should start with that as an opening premise, that the reason the Heter Iska is something that can be entertained pretty wide acceptance is because of that premise that the purpose of the prohibition of ribbis is to protect the chesed that's involved in lending money, and that's risk is applied to circumstances that are not about dire straits that people would need, but rather are looking for money for business purposes. And perhaps that could help us out. There are other indications along those lines that Terry Tanima goes into a discussion in his commentary to Parshas Bahar, where he notes that the Hatzeriska became appropriate because there was a major shift in how the economy was structured. So once upon a time, all of the income came from agricultural activities and and capitalism as we have it today. So that made two major differences. But once upon a time, if somebody asked for money, they were in great need personally, and there wasn't a significant opportunity cost to the provider in giving him that money. But that changed in 2 years, because now it's possible that somebody who's asking for money is not necessarily in dire straits, but rather needs it in order to be able to advance his business goals. And together with that, the one who's providing the money is undergoing an opportunity cost in providing it. He's not necessarily able to use that money in order to further his own investment goals as he otherwise may have. So those two aspects are significant, and also goes to explain why the spirit of the law at least could accommodate a different attitude.
I'll mention one more. Yeah.
This is a nice that I'm allowed to ask a question. And obviously, we spoke about Shemitah, and it seems that when it comes to ribbons, as you put on the said, the idea of happiness can become somewhat pretty regular. Yet when it comes to Shemitah, we say the idea of happiness is more BDM. The question is, what is the difference between them? And even going to the Tartanima, I think you're reversing the opposite direction when it comes to Shemitah. The Shemitah, where everything's agricultural, who I think is a bigger problem than when we had the Chira should actually work in such a case, versus today when there are many other professions that you sure work. So we're trying to see what the knock mean between those two quote unquote mitzvahs are.
So
when one is administered or become very prominent, you have to not much Shemitah.
All right, so let me see if I understand your question correctly. I think you're referring to the Heter Mechira for Shemitah, and that there seems to be somewhat of a comparison to be drawn, or that could be drawn, that the Heter Mechira, the idea, which has been in use for about 150 years now, at least widely, that there could be a sale of land before Shemitah, and that that would allow Shemitah to be not applied to that land. And that is very controversial, if I'm understanding what you're conveying here. And that, and the Heter Iska, which seems to be similar, perhaps, is less controversial and is more widely accepted. And
that's correct. And it also happens to be in the same fashion at the same time, but also, kind of the connection is just
all right.
General. Question.
So I greatly appreciate that question, because I just have to say for the record that I didn't plant that question. I didn't ask you to ask that question, but you're helping me out because you're allowing me to make a plug. That so I actually have a book coming out soon that's going to explain some of the chilukim and why one is accepted more and one is accepted less. So I wasn't necessarily intending, believe it or not, to make that a plug, but now because you're asking that question specifically, so I can exploit that and stress that that is true, that I'll have a lot more to say about that in that book, but just to try to address for the purposes of tonight. So it's a very important question, and I think there's quite a lot to say about it. And that's actually a little bit what I'm trying to address here, and we'll hopefully see a little bit more about as we go on, that when it came to Shemitah, without judging that right now, because the Hetzer Mechira was a topic of great machlokes, but was endorsed by many great gedolim, but there is a much greater controversy that surrounds it, because, among other things, it does seem like it undermines, perhaps completely, the spirit of the law, that the Torah says, don't work the land during Shemitah, and here this is a way of allowing the land to be worked. And what you're and a justification for any kind of a way of working around it seems to be even less present. So there are many who would agree with you very strongly, and there are many who would say that indeed that could explain why it is that the Hetzer Mechira has met with much greater controversy, as well as that, because of those very factors. While when it comes to Hetzer Iska, so perhaps the point is very different, that what we just tried to address in the past few minutes is why maybe from a spirit of the law perspective it's not necessarily so offensive. But the spirit of the law, maybe we can assume it, we're speculating, but maybe it's an interesting speculation.
Perhaps from the scope of the prohibitions. And that may be a very big part of why there is a different reception to the two. But before going further, you should note that even though nowadays the Hetzer Iska is widely accepted, I believe it's a fair statement, it hasn't always had 100% full endorsement. So we should just note that, and we'll say a few points about this as we go along. So first of all, there are those who understand, the Shema Sadeshim wrote, he had a lot to say about this, and the Gita Sforadim, he also took the position that we're dealing with Mr. Daraisa over this, so we shouldn't be so quick to use any kind of a tool. So that was Zahir's wishes, not necessarily 100% accepted in this context, but that was an attitude that certainly we did find. And it's also noteworthy that the tour writes that in general, that Ribis is a very tempting kind of prohibition, and we should be careful not to allow anything that can give in to that Yeshahara, that can feed that Yeshahara, and make it possible to earn money off of your lending to people. So there was some degree of resistance. Shachter often relates a story about, it's in one of the earlier Svarim, about somebody who had a dream, and in the dream, the person came to him and recently passed away. And that person was no longer living, appearing in the dream. He didn't look good at all. He looked terrible for a dead person. So the dreamer said, what's wrong? You don't look so good. And the deceased individual said that, yeah, I'm not having such a good time up in Shemayim. I'm in trouble here. They got me on Ribis. So the dreamer said to him, but you were always careful to use a Hetzer Iska. So why should you be in any trouble? And the deceased person said, yeah, that works down here. It doesn't work upstairs. We're not so happy about the Hetzer Iska up in Shemayim. So
that reflects an attitude that there was, even when it comes to the Hetzer Iska, certainly some
perhaps greater compatibility with the spirit of the law. And I'll add one more point to that, that is a sefer, my sefer,
a couple of the sechdes, and I've read this called Beis Matisyahu by Matisyahu Hirschman, where he notes that when it comes to ritual or rudeness, if we don't see that it's about exploitation.
As the sefer of four mentions Lelengel,
talking about the term
specifically, which means to bite into someone, that we understand that the problem is that here this person comes to you for help because they don't have money to begin with. So
if you say, okay, I'll help you, but you're going to owe me on top of that when you return the money, so then
they're going to have to find more money on top of giving you back your principal.
So then you are pushing them deeper into the hole. So then we can understand
why that's problematic. But if a person says to you, could you please lend me money because I want to use it for business?
So then you're saying, okay, you're going to take my money and you're going to turn it into more money.
So then, I'm really part of that. I'm not looking to make your service increase. I'm just saying that if you're going to actually be benefiting from the money that I'm giving you beyond of a law perspective is not necessarily
so terrible. So I think all of that could contribute, and hopefully also about why he's treated differently. Should also note that if factor, which also relates to what you were saying, Rabbi Yaakov, that in addition to questions of spirit of the law, so there's also letter of the law, which we'll
discuss
now, but when it comes to Shemitah, the letter of the law was also debated, whether it was effective or not, or whether it was permissible from a letter of the law perspective. So there's a lot
to discuss in that. But also, one of the factors in assessing whether these kinds of approaches are appropriate or not is the question of need, just how necessary it is. So, you were saying that Shemitah maybe is less of a problem nowadays because of the fact that there are additional methods of parnasa. So that should make it less pressing, and of course also the question of the general stability of the Israeli economy, and all of that contributes to a perception that maybe the need is less, although for those who thought the exact opposite way, that now you have an actual country that is dependent on this, and the need is greater, so how you assess the need was itself a debate. But so that was a big part of the calculation also. So, for example, Rabbi Yaakov Breisch,
Rechakis Yaakov,
has quite a few shulmas about Hatariska and about related things. He has many fascinating shulmas. But he has a hakdama to the section about Hatariska where he emphasizes just how necessary it is for the survival of the Jewish people economically, that in the contemporary economy they're not going to be able to participate at all if they couldn't collect on their helping people out with investments. So he writes that it's absolutely necessary for that purpose. And he had somewhat of a striking statement there. So we know that Chazal were makel for agunos. So here is a kavachomer, because agunos is only a small percentage of the population. And this applies to all Chai Yisrael. All Chai Yisrael is not going to be able to make it financially if we don't allow for the hatariska. So from a tzorach perspective, it is very pressing, and even more so than paying attention to the needs of agunos. So it's quite a strong statement, but that's also a part of the puzzle here. The assumption that this is highly necessary, and that's also a part of what the Torah Tmima was getting at in that presentation as well. So let's try to talk to us a little bit about
some of the structure here.
Of the law, there isn't necessarily a problem with this, but it still does violate the letter of the law. The letter of the law of the Torah does seem to prohibit any increase at all,
regardless
of why it's being provided or how reasonable it is. So how do we address the letter of the law? How exactly does the hetariska work? So the truth is there are a number of models. We'll kind of present them together, but different nuances between them, and they are largely credited to or largely traced to
Menachem Mendel Avigdor,
who lived in the 1600s.
He was a contemporary of the Bach, and he had a certain model which is based on a iska that is described by the Gemara in Bava Metzia,
and there's also a different version that is described by the Shulchan Aruch.
In terms of how a business partnership could work. And
this was then adapted by Mendel Avigdor's and by others also. The Chayyadim had a version.
There are a number of different versions with different nuances between them.
We're a little bit conflating
them all together for these purposes.
But the basic idea is
that you have a partnership here, and that the structure is not a lender and a borrower, but rather it is two partners who are involved in a business venture, and one is the active partner who's actually doing the work, and the other is the capital partner, is the one who is providing the funds in order for the business to function, but is not necessarily the active partner, not necessarily the one who is actually doing the labor. And again, there are different ways how to break it down, but you find the phrase palga milga, palga milga, upalga picado, that it is half of a loan, half of it is being given for borrowing purposes, and half of it is a picado. The recipient is supposed to protect it and make it more valuable, essentially treat it as a investment. So that's formulated this way. that, let's say, you have Melvin, we'll call them Mel and Louie. So Mel is the one who's not going to be called Melvin anymore, he's going to be called the provider, but he is, let's say, had Ribbis been permissible. So what he would have done was, he would have given Louie $1,000 as a loan, and he would have asked for 10% interest. So ultimately, he would have gotten back $1,100. He would have given him $1,000,
and when he got repaid, he would have gotten back $1,100.
But
you can't do that because Ribbis is prohibited. So what do we do instead?
So if we have this model of half loan, half investment, so
he could give him $500
as
a
straight out interest free loan. And that $500 will be returned to him without any increase, no more, no less. Exactly $500 will be returned for the $500 that was loaned.
Then the other $500, that's the picado.
So that is what's going to be used towards
getting an increase for Mel. So that is going to be treated as an investment. And basically we're saying, okay, I'm giving you this $500 and I expect a
20% return.
I expect to get back an extra $100.
So then the result will be that
in the whole total, there's
$1,000 being provided.
Half loan and half investment. And what's going to come back to Mel is going to be $1,100.
So essentially the result is going to be the same as if he provided a loan with 10% interest.
But it is
structured as partially a loan and partially an investment, and the loan has no interest, and it's only the investment
that
has the increase.
So
there are a couple of tricky points here.
So
one point is, okay, so that's all very well
and
good.
And let's assume that
the prohibition of interest is only applicable to a loan, it's not applicable to an investment.
So
fine. But what is a little tricky here is, how do you know that you're going to get a 20% return on the investment? Setting aside for a moment the fact that it's a pretty high return. But how can you predict any kind of return? Isn't that part of the definition of what a investment is and what differentiates it from a loan? That normally a loan is pretty much secure. Now there's always the possibility that the borrower could default, so it's risky in that sense. And you should note, by the way, that from that perspective, the Torah actually does allow the provider to try to guarantee that he won't undergo default, because there is permission, first of all, for the borrower not to lend to somebody he doesn't trust. But beyond that, he is allowed, and perhaps even encouraged, maybe it's even a mitzvah, to take a mashkan, take a security against default. So for many intents and purposes, there is a pretty much a guarantee that a loan will be repaid. So a loan is basically risk-free. While an investment is not risk-free. An investment has risk, and it could be that it won't be the rate that you're hoping for. It could be that there'll be no profit at all. And it could be that the recipient will lose all the money and it will all go away. So how is it that you can guarantee that not only will there be a profit, but that it'll be a profit of such a level? So that is probably where actually we have the greatest challenge to the spirit of the law. So just to take a moment to explain that, when we consider the spirit of the law and how to assess that, so there really are two halves of the equation. One is, how consistent is it with the intent of the Torah as we can best perceive it? And also, if we are structuring something a certain way, how sincere are we in that definition? So to give a comparison, so you brought up Hetz Bechira, so let's say there are two spirit of the law categories to consider. One is
every kind of mechanism to avoid the prohibition section. So that's one spur of the law question. But the second question is, okay, let's say if we were to accept that selling the land could actually absolve you of the prohibition section.
So let's say for a second we had no problem with that. But is the sale genuine? Is the sale really what we are claiming it is? Is it really a sale? So there was a tremendous controversy about that also.
So here, to break it down to the two questions, the first question is a little bit easier than the second question.
So maybe we could be confident that the spirit of the law doesn't have to necessarily be a problem here, in that maybe if it's for business purposes rather than chesed, it's not necessarily going to violate that spirit. But what about the question of what we're representing? Is that really accurate? So if we're saying that it is an investment rather than a loan, so is that true? If an investment has risk and a loan doesn't have risk, so is that the case here? So that is admittedly a little shakier, but there's what to work with there as well. So basically the idea is that should the recipient not meet that target, let's say the one who is taking the funds and then supposed to turn them into more, so let's say he doesn't reach that rate, or let's say he even doesn't make any profit or loses it all. So he comes back to Mel and he says, sorry Mel, I know you were hoping for 20%, but I actually have 0%. I actually don't have anything. I lost all the money. So Mel will say to him, yeah, of course you're going to tell me that, because it's in your interest to say that, no pun intended. It's to your benefit to claim that you didn't make it work, because then you don't have to pay me. So as far as I know, you actually did spectacularly well. You maybe made a terrific fortune, but you're telling me that you made nothing so that you shouldn't have to pay me. So I don't believe you. And if you want me to believe you, so then I'm going to demand a pretty high standard. So what I want you to do is, I want you to bring me proof that you didn't meet this target, and that proof is going to have to be, first of all, I want you to take a shvua, and we know that Jews are not so excited about taking shvuas, and I want you to bring witnesses, and not only normal witnesses, the witnesses I want, they should be your rabbi and their chazan, you should have them come down to my office and testify that indeed you didn't make this profit, which is going to be awkward, to say the least. It's an interesting discussion about whether that's just meant to be awkward or whether there's more to it. So it's actually based already in the Trumas Hadashah, and you find that standard. But in the earlier sources, this got a little bit lost in the later sources. But there was a reference that it's not stam that you're getting the rabbi just so that it'll be awkward, but the assumption is that the rabbi is holding a little bit in business, so it's not irrelevant. He does have some idea about what's going on here, and some mention that that's specifically that it shouldn't be a harama, that it shouldn't be a insincere. How you define harama in general is itself a whole discussion, but let's say for now something that's insincere or somewhat false. So in order to avoid that, it should actually be a rabbi who is holding in business, but there seems to be some combination here of it being difficult and awkward and maybe some relevance to the situation itself, but the expectation was that that's not going to be so likely. The person is not going to come and take a shvua, which we don't like doing, and bring the rabbi and the chazan to testify that he lost the money. So if you don't want to do all that, Mel says, okay, so I'll get you off the hook and just stick with the original agreement. So if you're going to come and pay the 20% that we agreed upon, so then I'm not going to demand any proof. I'll take your word for it that here's what you got and it wasn't more. But if you're going to ask for it to be anything less, so then I'm going to demand proof, and we should assume that that proof is probably not so likely to be forthcoming. So essentially that approach seems to negate the risk pretty much and seems to make it that there isn't really any downside for the provider. So that does seem to chip away at the genuineness of that framing, that turning it in from a loan into an investment, but it's kind of a secondary factor. And also, it's not absolute. There still is some risk. There still is some possibility that the recipient will go through all these hoops. Maybe he will say, maybe he will take a shvuah, and maybe he will be willing to bring these witnesses. So there is some degree of risk, and to the extent that there is some risk, so then we're still holding on a little bit to that initial distinction. So the more risk, the better, because that does bring it closer to a genuine formulation here
That is what we're looking for. Rav Shila Rafael, who was a prominent Dayan in Eretz Yisrael, he passed away a few decades ago already, but he suggests that nowadays people aren't so afraid of Shavuos anymore, and that's not such a factor, but maybe we should have a different approach, that we should say that if the recipient wants to come and say that he lost all the money, so then the provider can insist, okay, I want you to open up your books and show me everything, and I want to become a full active partner in what you're doing. So the assumption is that he's not going to be interested in doing all that, and therefore he'll say, okay, I'd rather just pay you the original rate, and we won't get involved in all that. Another reason why there is some degree of risk, and this also affects how it was carried out, that there is a whole discussion about what should happen if the purpose of the funds, the businesses that it was being used for, it's so well known as a failure that it's not really credible for the original provider to say he doesn't believe it. He doesn't have that plausible deniability. Let's say, for example, I were to say that I need to borrow some money because I have a great investment opportunity. There's this guy, Bernie Madoff, and he has this tremendous fund. And if I put the money in it, then I'm going to for sure do very well. And then the next day, he's literally the most famous person on the planet. His picture is on the front of every paper and every news magazine all over the world. So if the recipient comes back to me and says he lost it all, and I were to say, I don't believe you, I think this fund is still doing amazingly and that you're profiting like crazy, so it's not going to really make sense. It's not really going to be plausible that I could refuse to believe something which is very apparent to the whole world and is hard to question. So that impacts also how it's carried out. There were different attitudes as to how much the provider should know about what the recipient is doing. So there were those who argued that he really should try not to know too much because he wants to have that plausible deniability that if the recipient says my business didn't work out, so the provider will be able to say, indeed, I don't know. I am not aware of how it turned out, so I don't believe you. And if he knows more than that, then maybe he's risking not being able to refuse this claim because it'll be too apparent. On the other side, there were those who thought that there should be more transparency about what's going on. And that also goes to the question of just what purposes are valid for a heter iska, and we'll say more about that in a moment. But there was a major discussion in Poskim in general that if the provider knows that there wasn't any profit, so is he allowed to still ask for this whole protocol? Is he allowed to demand the shvua, knowing that the shvua is unnecessary? Because he's aware that there wasn't any profit. So that was the machlokas aposkim. There were a number of achronim who thought that if that was the situation, then it's not right to ask for a shvuah, and that indeed the risk factor is going to be more significant for that case. So then if it's so clear to him that there was no profit, he's not even allowed to demand a shvuah, and he has to forfeit that payment. While there were others who saw a little bit differently, so for example, the Marashag has a tshuva, where he writes that it's not a unnecessary shvuah because that's the deal. The deal was that if you want to get out of having to prove, so then you take a shvuah. So it's not unnecessary. It's a part of the protocol of what was agreed in advance, and there isn't anything wrong with the provider requesting that even under those circumstances. So that was a machlokas, or a machlokas and about other details as well. But that's a part of how that risk part is kept up. This is also relevant to another strange detail or surprising detail that comes up in the heter iska. Many people get involved in heter iska at least once in their lives, and they come across this detail and they have a hard time understanding it, that the provider gives the recipient a dollar. Why does he give him a dollar? Because there's an extra concern here, an additional problem. That if I'm giving you money, I'm giving you a loan, and then I'm giving you other money, and that other money, you're supposed to work and increase it for me to my benefit. So why are you doing that? Why are you working on my behalf? So it sounds like you're doing that because you're grateful, because I also gave you a loan at the same time. So the $500 loan, that helped you out. So in gratitude, you're taking my other $500, and you're working to benefit me. So
that has an appearance of ribbis. So in order to avoid that appearance, so you have to be working on retainer. I have to pay you something in order that you're not just doing it as a favor, you're doing it as my employee. Now it's kind of more of a concern rather than a reality of ribbis. So therefore, the standard to address it is very minimal. And you just have to pay a very token amount, what's the minimum that we consider hiring somebody for something. So that often translates to something like a dollar. But the purpose of that is so that the recipient is a paid employee of the provider and is helping him for that reason and not because he's grateful for the original loan. So all of that leads one perhaps to wonder, so is there another way of doing this that would have fewer problems? So there is another version, and that's called the Heter Iska Kulo Pikadon, that it's possible to do so in a way that, let's just skip this first part where you give the $500 as an interest-free loan, give the whole thousand as a Pikadon. And that would help in a few ways. So it would help, first of all, in that the rate would be more reasonable. And Rav Shlomo Zalman has a tshuva about this. Rav Shlomo Zalman Arbach has a tshuva where he notes that the rate itself seems to cause problems. That's a pretty high rate, what we described there, the 20% rate. And why are you giving such a favorable rate to the provider? That itself sounds like it's because you are grateful for the original loan, and that itself looks like a form of ribbis. So Shlomo Zalman writes, this is not sure what the answer is. He's not challenging the Heter Iska. He says the Heter Iska is widely makobo, and he's not objecting to its existence. But he says that is something that needs to be addressed, or explained at least. So if you were to use a Kulo Pikadon version, so then at least you're cutting that in half. At least your 10% is a lot also, but at least it's more credible than 20%. So that helps on that front. Also, if there's no loan, so then there probably can't be ribbis. That in order for there to be a possibility of ribbis, you need to have a halva. So some understood that this, making it a kulo pikadum eliminates the possibility of ribbis completely. And others understand that it knocks it down to a drabanan, but either way, it significantly reduces the risk of a Torah prohibition here by removing the loan factor completely. So the idea of a kulo pikadon formulation would help for a lot of these factors. So in some ways, that, or in many ways, that would be preferable. So why is that not the only form? Because that does increase the risk. So it may not be as attractive to the provider to use the kulo pikadon form, because whatever is in the halva bucket, like we said before, is pretty much guaranteed. And that there's no possibility of him taking a shvua or bringing other proof that it was lost. So it's more appealing to the provider to have half or as much as possible in the halva basket. But it solves other problems to eliminate the halva basket and put it all in the pikadon basket. So there's a trade-off there, and it addresses also this whole risk factor that was mentioned before. So there are pluses and minuses to converting it to a kulo pikadon form. But that also exists. There's a lot more to say about this. There's a whole other aspect that we didn't get to, but it's already getting late, so just mention a few other points. So there was a major discussion about what qualifies for a Heter Iska, given the whole introduction that we said that it really should only be used for business because of the spirit of the law for sure, and maybe also for the letter of the law. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he notes that he should appreciate that the Heter Iska is not a magic formula that you just say these words and all of a sudden everything becomes mutter. It has to make sense in terms of what you're doing. So if you were to whip out a Heter Iska because somebody asks you for help with their rent or with their groceries, so not only would it be inappropriate as far as the spirit of the law is concerned, but it also wouldn't seem to make sense as far as the letter of the law. So that may make it actually stam anisa deraisa ribis, because the functionality of the letter of the law in this case is based on the assumption that it is somewhat of a profit-generating endeavor. If there's no profit that's at least potentially coming in, so then the whole logic falls away. So it would seem that using the Heter Iska for a Chesed type loan would violate both the spirit of the law and the letter of the law. So that is the position that many poskim took. There were some, actually, earlier poskim, such as the Sholem Eishiv and others, who were a little bit more flexible on this point and thought that you could use a Heter Iska even for other kinds of circumstances, because the assumption basically being that money is fungible, and that even if right now I'm trying to pay my rent or pay for my groceries, but if I can't do that, so then I'm going to have to take away other funds that could be used towards making a living. So ultimately, I am less able to make a profit because of the distraction of my other financial pressures. So if you are helping me with any kind of financial pressure, so that contributes to my ability to make a living. So there were those who had a broader section of purposes that could allow for Heter Iska. Shnerbach has a discussion, actually, the Modim Uzmanim in Hochas Yom Kippur, because he talks about Tshuva on Yom Kippur. So he says, you know, while we're doing Tshuva, we should think carefully if we're violating Ribbis. That's an example of an Aveira we need to do Tshuva for, so it sounds like a funny fit. But in his Sefer on Yom Kippur, he has a lot about Ribbis there. So he discusses there that possibility that maybe people are invested in the stock market, so their funds are being used towards profit, so towards increasing their money. So whatever needs they have is a part of the whole puzzle towards how they're able to bring in further funds, and therefore maybe that could allow for a broader usage. But there were those, like the Moshe and others, who were more machmir, and we perhaps could appreciate that in light of our introduction at the beginning, that it really should only be used for potentially profitable endeavors. So it's a big question as to what would be included in that, and that is a discussion. So yes, things that could make a profit, shape business endeavors. It's probably widely accepted that buying a house is consistent with that also, because when one purchases a house, the expectation is that it's going to go up in value, even if that's not the reason you're buying the house, even if you're motivated to buy a house where you have somewhere to live. But that doesn't take away from the fact that the hope is that the house is going to go up in value. So therefore, that creates the context for the Heter Iska to be valid. So to use the Heter Iska for the purchase of a house, for a mortgage, that's pretty widely accepted. Many assume that it could also be used for student loans, because the assumption is a student loan is an investment in the earning potential of the recipient. So therefore, that also could connect to some future returns, and that could also justify the usage of the Heter Iska. So that's a part of the discussion, what circumstances could it be used for. But to use it for chesed situations, as we noted, is a highly problematic spirit of the law, and probably that of the law also. And the Chafetz Chaim has a lot to say about this in the Sefer Avos Chesed, and it's not 100% clear what exactly he's saying, as there's different ways of reading it, but he certainly seems to be saying that if one were to lend money to a person in need with a Heter Iska, so that he would not be fulfilling chesed, that would not be a chesed, which is so central to the whole obligation of Havah, as we see in the Parsha and elsewhere. But he may be also saying that even if you're using it for straight out business purposes, where it should be completely consistent, there is a cost here as well, and we maybe alluded to this at the beginning, that if we want people to be able to provide for those in need, and assuming that everyone only has a finite sum of money that he could free up to be lending to people, but now it's possible to lend at a profit because you can give it to business people with a Heter Iska, so then that's going to divert money that could be used for chesed, of just helping out people in need, and that's going to end up, yes, detracting from the chesed that exists in the world. So it could be that there is an issue even on that level, or at least something to keep in mind, and that one who's going to do this should be aware that he's also supposed to lend money to people who can't pay any extra and who need to pay for their rent and for their medical bills, and to have enough available to do that, even while he's also making investments with the Heter Iska that is coming back at a profit. So that was also part of a consideration. The truth is, there's a lot more really to say about this, so want to add a few more details and maybe talk about another interesting historical aspect of how the Hetzer Iskah was utilized or was suggested. So I think we'll have to have at least one other part about this. But I don't think we'll do it next week, because I also want to talk about at least one topic related to Shavuos. So probably take a break from this topic for next week to do something more Shavuos related. Although stay tuned, because we'll announce exactly what it is. And then maybe after Shavuos we'll come back and do another part on Hetzer Iskah. Maybe some more ribbons. We'll see what we can fit in or what is the priority at that time. So we'll stop here, and wish you all a wonderful night, and God willing, stay tuned for next week's plans. We'll probably talk about something else. Everyone should have a wonderful night and a wonderful week.